Hello, and welcome to this episode of Tales of the Sea. I'm Mark Winkworth. Today I want to talk about a humble but extremely important inhabitant of the sea, known as the starfish, or more accurately, the sea star. I recently learned some new facts about sea stars, and first off, I was surprised at the number of varieties. Sometimes sea stars are yellow, sometimes pink, they can also be blue, and many, many other colors. In Christian mythology, the starfish represents the Virgin Mary. Matter of fact, the church I attended when I was a kid growing up in Michigan was dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and it was called Our Lady Star of the Sea. I had no idea that Stella Maris, the Star of the Sea, was in any way connected to the sea star, nor do I suspect any of the parishioners did either. To the Egyptians, the starfish was connected to the goddess Isis. She had the ability to regenerate life and cure diseases. To some, Isis was also a guardian to troubled seafarers. Kids today likely think of one of the more colorful characters in the popular animated TV show SpongeBob SquarePants, known as Patrick Star. Patrick is one of the inhabitants of Bikini Bottom and SpongeBob's best friend. Patrick is an overweight pink starfish who lives under a rock and often has crazy ideas that far too often get the friends into big trouble. I confess to being a romantic appreciator of the sea star, who to this point knew little about the dangers to the fragile ecosystem of our ocean should they suddenly disappear. The species, it turns out, are extremely important to the health of the marine environment. A recent article in the Maine Islands Institute newsletter quoted a young marine biologist on the current threat to the species. Andrew McCracken, a current PhD student at the University of Vermont, is on a quest along with his fellow marine biologists to discover possible answers to this pending crisis for these fragile creatures. I wanted to begin by hearing his thoughts on why this ancient creature held such fascination for people all over the world.
Well, I personally don't know the history of people's fascination with like starfish or sea stars. I think it must have to do something about their kind of like alien-like appearance and their ease and accessibility that they have really like globally in rocky intertidal shores. Like, you know, you have starfish all over the planet, from the Arctic to like the Mediterranean, off the coast of Maine, like everywhere. And like, I feel like they're one of the like most interesting, most different creatures that like really anybody can see without having to like dive, like go diving deep in the ocean.
Andrew is a National Science Foundation graduate research fellow at work on a 3-year study of just how thermal extremes impact physiological changes in these and similar creatures. You know, when you're kids, you discover all these things that are within wading distance of the shore, and sea stars or starfish are considered critical to their marine environment. In fact, there's even a term for these creatures who appear to have a larger impact on the respective ecosystems than other species. They're called keystone species. Examples range from the tiny starfish to the mighty African elephant. Andrew, what exactly is meant by the term keystone species?
Well, a keystone species is an organism that is so essential to the function of the ecosystem that is in that if it is removed or somehow its dynamics with the environment changes, it has really large-scale impacts that can cascade across multiple trophic levels. If these organisms are removed, which is the case with the starfish, it can have these really, really drastic consequences. Sea stars are actually the original keystone species.
Is that right? What makes sea stars a keystone?
That term was actually defined off of some studies done by ecologist Robert Payne in the 1960s, noting the importance of starfish in the community composition of rocky intertidal shores in the Pacific Northwest. They play such a significant role as a top-down predator of mussels and sea urchins and other benthic invertebrates that they keep these other organisms and animals in check. So without the starfish, mussels and sea urchins and everything that they eat are able to just kind of grow out of control.
And that's true of sea stars all over the world and different parts of the United States?
In the case on the West Coast at the moment, this is really seen. currently with the sea urchin populations, the purple sea urchin, which are their populations are starting to just grow and grow and grow and grow. People are going diving and just like bringing them up on shore and cracking them on rocks to reduce their population size because sea urchins love to eat kelp. And the kelp forests out in the Pacific are such an essential resource, both ecologically and economically, with like the fisheries, since it supplies such essential habitat to so many other organisms. So you remove the starfish, the sea urchins proliferate, eat and mow down the kelp forest, and you're left with these just sea urchin barrens, is what they're called. It's really nothing but just rocks and sea urchins. And you have a complete change in ecosystem from these beautiful flourishing kelp forests to sea urchin barrens. And that's really what it means to be a keystone species, because it plays such an important role in maintaining that essential habitat.
It is amazing. And I did not realize that sea stars were the original keystone species, which is amazing. But I was looking around and I thought, okay, well, what other creatures on the planet are considered keystone? You know, sharks and sea otters of all things. If you think of the size of a sea star, and you think of an elephant, which is, if I'm correct, also a keystone species. I mean, it's amazing that something as small and some might say, you know, insignificant would be, you know, right up there with an elephant as to how important it was to their own ecosystem. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, we can go even smaller. And another organism that we are very concerned about in terms of conservation and global climate change is bees. They are a keystone species as well as one of a key pollinator. So now we're looking outside of animals. And without bees, trees and flowers and things, flowering plants can't be pollinated, and therefore they will struggle to reproduce the next year as well. That is just also a very heavy cascading effect if bees are removed from the ecosystem, and they are very much struggling as well.
Right, right. So obviously all over the planet, you pull the plug on any one of these keystone species, and it has an enormous impact on so many other creatures.
I like to think about it as kind of like a game of Jenga. As well, like you might like pull one of those bottom pieces and the whole thing comes falling down, but you could also place a piece on top just in the wrong spot and the tower can come down as well. So
right, that's a great point. Let's just go back to your childhood and your earliest memories of the sea.
I grew up in Topsom, Maine, about 30 minutes north of Portland. Some of my earliest memories of the ocean is sailing around Muir Point out of Brunswick with my family and the friends. My grandparents lived in Cape Cod, and we had like a little boat which we would take out and around and go fishing. We'd also sail down there. Lots and lots of days spent on the beaches exploring the rocky shores of Maine.
Yeah, yeah. And were you fascinated as a kid by the tide pools and all the creatures that hung out along the shore?
Oh, absolutely. I would take critters from one tide pool and bring them to another. Like I would have one central one. I'd be like, okay, like how many different things can I find and bring it to like this, like one tide pool. And then I could like look at my little collection for the day. I would never take them out and bring them home, but I would like see what I could find. I actually never found starfish while growing up, which is the interesting part. I don't think they are as abundant in southern Maine, and you have to go a little bit further up to find them. But yeah, it was that was a big pastime of mine.
Where do they thrive? I mean, what kind of environment, whether it's temperature or shore, you know, you say you don't really see them that much. And I know I haven't seen them since we've been in southern Maine. But as you look around the world, where do they really thrive? Where are their populations the biggest?
Well, they definitely are in southern Maine. They're just not as close to the sandy beaches you would probably usually be exploring. Sea stars are globally distributed. You can find them in the Arctic. You can find them in the deep, deep ocean, like past where the light reaches. You can find them here on the East Coast. You can find them like in huge numbers out on the West Coast as well, in the Mediterranean Sea, out in Europe, like really every ocean you can think about, there are starfish.
They go back hundreds of millions of years, no doubt, right?
Yes, they're actually thought to be one of our closest, like I say, closest relatives very freely in terms of the branch of the evolutionary tree before bilaterians, which are these kind of like, if you were to look at us in kind of a cross section, we mirror each other, we mirror ourselves down the center.
Obviously, at some point, grade school or high school or college, you latched on to this course of study that you're obviously deep into now. Was there anyone in particular who influenced that?
I will start by saying that my research interests are definitely still developing and changing. I think that is just kind of the fun of science, is that you can pursue all different courses of interest.
I can see that.
I had always entertained the idea of being a marine biologist, even starting at a young age. I remember career fairs back in like high school and being like, where's marine biologists to talk to? I loved the field trips that we took in elementary school to the Gulf of Maine Research Institute in Portland and looking at like, oh, this would be so cool to like work and research at a place somewhere like this. Those interests definitely wavered over my professional development. Back in college, I remember entertaining the idea of going to med school at one point and ended up like ditching that and looking at really animal behavior and neurobiology started to interest me. After college, I just applied to lab technician positions and ended up working in a stem cell research lab in Boston for a while, the Center for Regenerative Medicine at Boston University and Boston Medical Center. And it was at that point where I was learning all these really cool like scientific and laboratory skills, amplifying DNA using CRISPR gene editing technologies and stuff. And I kind of sat back and thought to myself, is this what I want to be applying myself to do? Hearing about this was in the middle of the global pandemic, for example, when I was applying to grad schools. Obviously, human health was a very big concern, but at the same time, we were having all these massive wildfires. We have this like increase of wildlife diseases that are actually spilling over to humans. Who knows what the actual cause of COVID-19 was, but it's a very high chance that it was some zoonotic spillover from species such as a bat. And this got me really thinking about the research that I wanted to conduct. And I wanted to migrate back to this idea of how are animals, not just humans, going to adapt to global change in the future with these very fast-paced changes that are occurring. And that's when I found Melissa Paspini at the University of Vermont, who was heading a lab, and the whole theme of the lab is adaptation to global change. When I started my first year of my PhD, she had this kind of like half-started project looking at sea star wasting disease and its connections to global warming, marine heat waves and such, and really looking into the microbiome, all the microorganisms that live on the starfish in association with this disease. And I'm like, wow, this is so cool. And that has really formed into the center of focus for my research now, which is looking at how marine organisms specifically deal with these multiple really strong selective pressures in their environment, such as temperature and coinciding disease conditions, which can be both alone can have very high mortality rates.
Your point about change and adaptability, every time, you know, there seems to be a prediction about how fast things are changing. It seems now that things are going faster, right? It seems like, oh, well, that was going to take 5 years. Now it's like, it's already there.
I remember going to like the beaches up in Maine. I loved going to like Head Beach and stuff. And you would literally wade into the water and just wait for your body to go numb before you can enjoy splashing around and you don't feel like the freezing cold anymore.
Totally true. I just want to talk for a second about the terminology. Is it incorrect to say starfish like we've done most of my entire life? Or is that something that has changed, you know, recently? That suddenly, you know, it's not a fish, it's a sea star.
I think you're kind of, you know, hitting the nail on the head there. It indeed is not a fish. So calling it a starfish is just slightly inaccurate. But this is just a common term that we use. And that is perfectly fine and very interchangeable with sea star, which is just, I think, within at least the scientific community, when we are publishing papers, it's just a little more accurate to not call them fish, because that is a completely different branch of the evolutionary tree.
The other thing is that most people think these creatures have like five arms or more than five arms, but it's not, that's not correct to call them arms, right?
They're arms. Yeah. We do call them arms, and you're correct. They, not all of them have five. There are many species that have six arms, and sunflower sea star, which is the species that I've been looking closely into for my research, can have up to like 28 arms.
Wow.
And they can be like 2 feet across. Like, they are some of the largest species in the world.
Whoa. Wow. So it's okay to call them arms. And they also have some kind of eye at the end of these arms, correct?
And yes, they do have little eyes at the tips of their arms. And when we say eyes in this sense, they are light receptors. They do not have binocular vision like we do. Their ability to actually discern edges and shapes is not even close to the degree that we can, but they are able to detect changes in light and potentially like approaching threats.
Just talk for a minute about the fact that they, if I'm correct, they have no brain and they have no blood.
Yeah. So, no, they don't really have a brain. They have kind of this like cast of neurons throughout their body and some ganglia, which would be like clusters of neurons that control behavior and movement. And no, they don't have blood in the same way we think of it. They have an open circulatory system, which actually brings in fresh seawater, which they use to pump around their body. And this is actually how they move as well. They have a bunch of little tube feet at the bottom of their arms, which they pump water through to actually help move their body. If you bring them out of water, they are immobile and they're not able to move those limbs. And as for the blood, they have something kind of similar within that open circulatory system that they have. They have numerous numbers of different cell types that are macrophage-like, like we would think about like white blood cells that have that play a really key role in their immune function.
So they move by means of like literally jetting water through these tubes. Are they constantly filtering and bringing in food through that filtering? What are they eating?
Yeah, so they eat mussels and clams and sea urchins and snails and all kinds of different, usually non-moving or very slow-moving benthic marine invertebrates. And they do so actually by just kind of usually crawling over them, and they externally regurgitate their stomach to envelop whatever they are eating. They are with their really actually very strong arms and 2 feet. They have kind of suckers, which they can pull apart these mussel and clam shells. And then they kind of just like digest and extract the inside.
Their arms allow them to pull like a mussel shell apart?
Yeah, so they have very strong suction, and you can think about the arms like taking either side and slowly pulling apart the mussel shell.
They have full movement of the arms? They can actually wrap them around something?
Yes, they can wrap around. They're actually very flexible. They are able to, through what's known as their catch collagen system, which is their muscular system, is make those very, very rigid when they want to stick to something very tense, which is if you're going to interact with them, they're going to make themselves as rigid and like stuck to the rock as possible so you can't pick them up.
So you talked about the issue on the West Coast with the sea star wasting disease. I really want to hear more about that. But first, can we, just for a second, can we take a look at our coast here in Maine? What is the biggest threat? And have the sea stars begun to, in fact, disappear? If so, how is that likely to affect the marine ecosystem?
My best guess over here on the East Coast, we really don't know what might happen. The starfish, see, I even call them starfish because like we're just so used to it. They will mostly be preying on like mussel beds and whatnot, and they can keep essentially by eating mussels and other these marine vertebrates, they allow space for other organisms to thrive. If these like mussels, for example, are just left completely like untouched by the starfish, they might be the only organism populating the area. And there's no room for different barnacles or less competitive mussel species or snails and other things to take up those areas. Essentially, you just get this reduction of biodiversity. And it is known that more diverse communities are more resilient to change. So we might not see this direct impact, such as sea urchins completely like wiping out the kelp forests, for example. But there could be some unknown potential cascading consequences, especially as these ecosystems are trying to adapt to all these global change conditions as well.
Right. I'd like to go back for just a moment back to your work on the West Coast. And is there anything now understood about the causes of the wasting disease? And what specifically does it do to the sea stars, just in terms of how it manifests itself and develops and so on?
In terms of its cause, that's the big question. We still don't know. We have tried to, the royal we in the scientific community, have tried to screen for viruses and whatnot and have not come up with a singular smoking gun, I guess, like a singular cause. I have been looking into changes in the microbiome associated with sea star wasting. There's numerous other diseases that impact sea urchins and sea cucumbers and other echinoderms that are caused by bacteria. However, there's so many marine bacteria out there, it's really hard to kind of like tease apart what might be responsible. And it could be a multi-step disease as well, which is more thought to be probably this combination of both biotic and abiotic factors, such as these big heat wave events that are occurring, could be stressing the sea stars out, which, you know, when we're really stressed, our immune system doesn't work as well. Similar with theirs. However, it has been shown to be contagious between species and within the same species as well. So even under non-stress conditions in the laboratory, you can put two sick starfish and a healthy one in the same bin together, even just through water flow through and them not touching, and you can transmit the disease. So there's still a lot of questions out there as to what is causing it, but hopefully we are getting closer.
What happens literally to the starfish who contracts this disease or condition?
It often presents itself in the starfish with often they stop moving as much. They start to kind of contort and twist their arms, showing that it might be impacting their like nervous system in potentially some way. And this is usually followed by lesions on their arms, limbs, and body. And eventually the starfish literally pulls itself apart.
Oh, wow.
Leaving its limbs behind. I have seen this happen in real time, and their arm is like still active and fine, stuck to the side of the tank, and it will just crawl away from its own arms and pull itself apart. It's really gruesome and sad to watch.
Wow. Yeah, that's really, so literally it pulls itself apart and then just dissolves. It's like just gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it just kind of dissolves the lesions and the tissue just kind of becomes necrotic and wastes away. And this can happen very quickly. In a matter of days to like a week, a perfectly healthy sea star, like I've seen them die within 24 hours of the first symptom, visible symptom, that is. And we're trying to look into what's going on behind the scenes.
In terms of the actual research, were you literally like in the field or in the water observing, or is this how is this research done?
So I had the wonderful opportunity to work with the Hakai Institute of British Columbia last summer up on the Washington coast up near Olympic National Park to study this disease. And we went into the field and we collected wild starfish sea stars, the sunflower sea star, and a couple other species such as the ochre sea star and leather star, and brought them into the lab where they were all kind of sectioned in very quarantined containers so they couldn't spread it to each other. And we observed and took samples of the progression of the disease.
Yeah. Wow. Are there males and females? And is there anything resembling any kind of social structure?
It's really hard to distinguish. Like, you can't really distinguish males and females, but they do reproduce sexually. And in terms of social structure, not really. They tend to gather in areas that are good for like feeding and where the food is. So you usually find them in groups, kind of clung to rocks together.
So there is no brain. There's no brain, but there is a nervous system that reacts to stimuli. Obviously, a nervous system means that there is some sensation, whether it's like, hey, I just lost an arm, or someone took a bite out of me. But I think it's the regeneration that I think has inspired cultures. The fact that that they can lose an arm or multiple arms and grow them back. I mean, there aren't that many creatures that can actually regenerate. I mean, there are a number of them, but does that happen frequently?
Under these non-disease conditions, for these sea stars, yes, most species can regenerate entire limbs, or if you cut them in half, they can regrow even parts of their body. And that is usually a defense response for predation. They can actually purposely detach one of those arms, kind of like when they're walking away from it with this disease, in the presence of, let's say, like a crab coming over and trying to take a snack. And they can slowly regenerate it back. But that does not happen in the case of this wasting disease. They do not regenerate.
So you mentioned a crab. I was going to ask about predators. I mean, do starfish, are they regularly snacked on or eaten?
It's not uncommon, but they don't have any like very strong predation pressures. You have crabs and lobsters and some bottom-dwelling fish that will eat them, as well as like seagulls and stuff as well.
So just back for a moment to the wasting disease, is there any sign that they have found a way to adapt? Any signs at this point that they're going to find a way to combat that disease?
So that's a very big question in the field and something I'm currently trying to look into. So it's very species dependent in that sense. You have some species such as the leather star, which seems just not to get sick from this wasting disease. We've tried to infect them with it in that lab. They did not get sick. Others such as the ochre sea star, they do get sick, and very rarely you can actually find some that recover, who showed signs of disease and then were able to make it out. But that's a very small proportion. And other species, such as the sunflower sea star, which is, again, the focus of my research, which seemingly has a 100% non-questionable mortality. Some populations' genetic studies have been conducted to look at populations before and after these outbreaks, because you would assume that ones that can survive after getting sick might pass down those beneficial traits to their offspring. But we have yet to find signals of that as of yet. We really don't understand the way that this disease is interacting, and that is a very big question. I'm actually looking at sea urchins, which are a relative of the sea star, both echinoderms at least, and subjecting them to some selection experiments in the lab here in Vermont. Where you take a population before and the surviving population after a bacterial pathogen, which I will be introducing, to see if we can find signals of adaptation within the lab and then maybe use that to inform some field studies.
Do humans have a big impact? I know fishing, especially like, you know, bottom scraping or trawling or whatever, could have an impact. But in general, do humans have a large impact on a critter like the sea star?
I'd say that depends. At the individual level, if you were to pick up a starfish, dry it out, and take it home like once, that's not going to have a huge impact, though, you know, we would like to keep as many of them in the ocean as possible. It would be the people who are collecting many, many, many of them, especially from like one area, that could wipe out that subpopulation. And then, you know, drying them, selling them as jewelry or just trinkets and stuff at home you see in all these shops that are around. That, if done regularly, could potentially have some negative effects. Larger populations are more resilient to change, and any major reduction of that would potentially impact their capability to adapt.
In terms of what's coming up for you and the folks you work with in the lab, you're continuing to do this research in search of the possible culprit for wasting disease, and who knows what else is waiting around the corner. But inevitably, a keystone species, any creature, right, has to figure out a way to adapt to what's going on, the climate, no matter who the cause, but they've got to figure out a way to adapt. Otherwise, as you say, it's the collapse. Do you see signs that these vital creatures can, in fact, adapt to the changes that we're going through, or will some inevitably, you know, disappear?
I think that with the way things have progressed so far, like beyond stopping climate change itself, it's going to be really hard to protect some of these many of these species. And that's one of the most frustrating parts of this kind of study is like, where is the light at the end of the tunnel? I think that what we are doing here right now is actually a huge step toward that, educating the public about these concerns. The more support that we can have to establish marine protected areas are going to give these species and these ecosystems the best chance that they have to adapt. Because if a population is struggling with heat waves or disease or both at the same time, and then you're taking away essential resources by overfishing or trolling and completely devastating their habitat in a different way through direct human impact, then you're, pulling the rug out from under them from whatever little bit of hope they were clinging on to. So I think that just spreading awareness, helping establish and supporting marine protective areas and this kind of research is really the way forward. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years, but let's hope that we can all get through it together.
Hear, hear, I'd say to that. And I echo your sentiment that I think the more people know, the more they can help. I think awareness and, getting the word out is got to be a big part of it. Listen, I just want to thank you for spending some time.
Of course. Yeah, no, this has been a really entertaining discussion. Yeah, I'm always happy to share my research.
Thanks, Andrew. And best of luck to you and the team. That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. A special thanks to Andrew McCracken and his team at the University of Vermont. I personally look forward to catching up with them in the future and seeing what pieces of the mystery they may have unraveled in this particular case. If you enjoyed the episode, please tell a friend or two, and remember, you can find Tales of the Sea wherever you stream your favorite podcasts. This is Mark Winkworth. Thanks for listening.